amendment to the APS regulations. As stated in the public notice, the proposed amendment to revise the RPS regulations to address policy-related changes, including require changes to the RPS Class 1 to Class 2 regulations in order to implement Section 12 of Chapter 227 of the Acts of 2018, now codified in Mass General Law, Massachusetts General Laws, Chapter 25A, Section 11F, and in the APS regulations eliminating the transition from pre-minting of certificates to forward minting of certificates for eligible small, non-emitting renewable energy technology. The purpose of this public hearing is to receive verbal and written comments on the proposed amendments to the RPS and APS regulations. As indicated in the public notice, written testimony will be accepted until 5 p.m. on June 7, 2019 for RPS Class 1 and RPS Class 2, and today, May 13th, APS. This public hearing is being recorded and will be posted in the department's website. The department requests that, to the extent possible, parties also submit written copies of their testimony. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming today. So my name is Mike Judge. I'm the director of the Renewable and Alternative Energy Division at DOER, and I'm joined by Dan Burstein, Samantha Meserve, Eric Stelzer, Jonathan Parrott, and John Wassum. So we have about 20 or so people signed up for to submit comments or submit testimony. So we're going to just go through that list in order. If people can keep it to about 5 minutes or so, I think that'd be great. But if there's more time at the end, we can add additional people. And then we can also allow for people who may have been cut short to have more time. So I'm just going to start going down the list. For the first person we have is William Muma.
Thank you very much for having these hearings and for the opportunity to present to you. I'm William R. Muma, Emeritus Professor of Tufts University and Director of a center, research center there. I have been working on climate change for 31 years and have been an author of five major Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, including the one on renewable energy, including bioenergy. This last October, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change called for urgent action to address climate change immediately after examining thousands of research articles. It is essential to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions by 25% to 45% by 2030 and not exceed the capacity of natural systems to remove atmospheric carbon dioxide by 2050. This is a condition sometimes referred to as carbon neutrality. However, because the United States and other nations have procrastinated, carbon neutrality is not enough. We must now become carbon negative after 2050, meaning we must not emit more than natural systems can remove from the atmosphere. And we need to both reduce our combustion of all fuels and materials that release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and increase the removal rate by natural systems. Halting the burning of wood will be more effective than reducing the burning of coal. The IPCC and the UN concluded the only means we have for sequestering sufficient carbon dioxide is in sufficient amounts in a timely fashion is by our forests. If left to the marketplace, we would not be burning wood either for heat or for making electricity. Financial analysis finds that producing electricity by burning wood, high-emitting wood, is more expensive than producing electricity from wind and solar that emit no carbon dioxide. However, the current regulations in the alternative portfolio standard provide large subsidies from electric ratepayers to support the burning of wood by treating it as a zero carbon source, despite the fact that the conversion of heat energy to electricity is far less efficient and emits more carbon dioxide than burning any fossil fuel. Bioenergy power stations can also qualify for some subsidy if they utilize just half of the heat energy released in combustion under the renewable portfolio standard. Proposed changes will subsidize even more emissions. DOER proposes to relax the regulations on wood burning under both APS and RPS by identifying many additional ways that burning wood from our forests can be rewarded. In other words, we in the public are being forced to pay more to put additional carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and simultaneously reduce the capacity of our forests to remove even as much atmospheric carbon dioxide as they are today. Massachusetts prides itself on having the greatest concentration of scientific research in the world. In 2008, the Commonwealth commissioned the Manomet study that concluded that it took many decades to a century for forests that have been cut and burned in order to make electricity to bring added to absorb atmospheric carbon dioxide to the levels of coal combustion. In 2014, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change concluded that the combustion of biomass generates gross emissions roughly equivalent to the combustion of fossil fuels. If bioenergy production is to generate net reductions in emissions, it must do so by offsetting those emissions through increased net carbon uptake of biota and soils. It goes on to say that the shortcomings of the climate neutrality assumption have been extensively discussed. And I'll leave a copy of this report. It's only 2 pages, very short for a report, that part of the report. Since then, scientists from the University of Massachusetts Lowell and MIT have done additional analysis, and they too have found in detail exactly where the carbon is at all times. And if I may, I would like to leave a copy of that report as well. It was published just last January in a special issue of a journal of which I was a guest co-editor. The proposed rules by DOER to increase wood burning defy the logic of basic science. They are incompatible with the urgent warnings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They increase Massachusetts' contribution to climate change and undermine the Massachusetts Global Warming Solutions Act and the requirements of the Supreme Judicial Court that actions to reduce emissions be taken. I urge DOER not to implement any of the proposed changes in regulations for forest bioenergy, but instead to remove all bioenergy from the APS and RPS and halt all state bioenergy subsidies. We are in a desperate race against time, and it is essential that we rapidly halt all the sources of heat-trapping gases and increase carbon dioxide sequestration by letting more of our forests grow through a management technique called proforestation. And then the ratepayer funds that are now being wasted supporting the burning of wood that increases climate change can be spent instead to reduce emissions by supporting energy efficiency, zero-emission energy sources like wind and solar, and technologies like heat pumps, heating and cooling. Thank you very much. I'm available for any questions, and I'd like to leave these materials with you, if I may.
Thank you. Feel free to leave us with written copies. The next person we have signed up is Chris Egan.
Thanks. I'm Chris Egan from Mass Forest Alliance, and we represent forest landowners, foresters, timber harvesters, and forest products companies in Massachusetts. And thanks for the opportunity to comment on these regulations. First, I wanted to applaud DOER for simplifying the process of qualifying woody biomass in the regulations. The previous regulations, while well-intentioned, they were in practice so severe a burden that foresters simply refused to qualify the wood under the RPS. People told us that they might double their time on a project to meet the guidelines, to meet the previous regulations. And that meant that we either have to absorb that economic loss themselves or charge it off to the forest landowner. And there really wasn't any economic gain because any wood qualified for the RPS didn't sell at premium, and there was limited markets anyway. So this is sort of a simpler, common-sense approach. we've seen these regulations in action. You recognize there was a problem, and you're moving to address it. We think that's admirable. And we also applaud the decision to make forest salvage wood exempt from the efficiency standards. Our forests today face an onslaught of invasive insects and diseases that are having a serious and severe impact on forest health. The emerald ash borer is killing all the ash trees in Massachusetts. They're projected to disappear in the next 20 years. Gypsy moths are back, especially in central Massachusetts, killing hundreds of thousands of oak trees. There are new threats on the horizon, spotted lanternfly, and a whole series of things. So we're seeing a tremendous amount of tree mortality in our forests. In fact, tree mortality is more than double tree harvesting in Massachusetts. And as we know, dead trees don't absorb any more carbon. So encouraging salvage work can speed up the regeneration of the forests, encourage new growth that will help sequester carbon going forward. And we think this regulatory change will help create additional markets for that wood, and so it's a benefit in the long term to forest health. There's one proposed change that we'd encourage you to revisit, and that's the disqualification of woody biomass sourced from land conversion operations, land clearing. And I want to be clear here, our goal is to keep forests as forests, as working forests, certainly, but as forests. And so we're not in the habit of promoting or endorsing deforestation, which means the conversion of forest land to permanently to another land use. However, our feeling is if that has been permitted and the project is going to move forward, it's better to do something productive with that wood than simply let it decompose and release its carbon anyway. And this may actually go back to the first point. The high efficiency standards meant that foresters really wouldn't qualify residues or thinnings for the RPS. And the efficiency standards also meant large plants couldn't qualify to create electricity. But there were smaller combined heat and power CHP facilities that could meet those efficiency standards, then could use forest-derived wood. However, because that wood was not being qualified by foresters, they couldn't get any. And so they ended up using mostly land-clearing wood. So this gave the perception that the RPS was encouraging land-clearing. That's simply not the case. Changing the land use from forest to something else, a housing development or an office park, it's quite expensive to do, generally from $1,000 to $5,000 an acre. Getting a few $100 for residues isn't going to make anyone go forward with a project to convert forest land for other uses. And given that it's being converted, you can't leave the residues or the slash, as it's known, behind. It has to be all chipped and removed. And so what's happening now is sometimes those chips are driven as far away to other states, or sometimes they're simply dumped and left to decompose. So we'd rather see that wood be used for productive purposes to generate heat or power, and we encourage you to revisit that change. And finally, of course, we believe that it would be better for forest health long term, given that tree mortality so significantly outweighs harvesting, that residues and thinnings be removed and made from the efficiency requirements and made easier to use. We think that would be a benefit not only to our members but to forests as large. We'll submit written comments at a later date. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Randy Soldaziak.
Hello, my name is Randy Soltysiak. Is this on?
Should be.
It's not.
I'm here on behalf of my daughter, April, who is 11, and my son, Ari, who is 8. Thank you for holding this hearing today. I'm part of the group Mothers Out Front. We are working for a swift, complete, and just transition away from fossil fuels to clean energy because climate change is threatening our children's future and actually our children's present. Climate change is happening now, and it poses a threat to everyone in this room today. Yesterday was Mother's Day, my daughter April said to me, Mom, I'm going to be a mother someday, so I'm celebrating Mother's Day too. And I had to hold back tears because I do hope she gets to be a mother someday, but I really don't know what the future will look like for her when she's an adult. I mostly try not to think about the IPCC report and what things will look like in 11 years because it's devastating and overwhelming. But instead of being paralyzed, I'm here speaking out because I still believe that we can make choices today that can change the course we are on. Choosing to weaken the standards regulating biomass and indeed to even include it at all in the definition of a renewable energy source is the wrong choice. It's a choice that threatens my children and your children and everyone in this room because of climate change. We need to be reforesting and planting trees on a massive scale, not cutting down trees and burning them. This is my daughter's inhaler. We are lucky that her asthma is not severe and that we don't live in the immediate vicinity of a biomass plant because that would make breathing a lot harder for her and everyone who does live near it. Members of the Department of Energy Resources, I urge you to use your power to make the choice today that will protect children. I urge you to not subsidize biomass as a source of renewable energy and not to weaken the standards we currently have for regulating it. When we include biomass as a renewable energy source, we are contributing to climate change. And in 2019, it is not a radical idea to link climate change to genocide. A New York Magazine article from October 2018, headline reads, UN says climate genocide is coming, but it's worse than that. Massachusetts DOER, please connect the dots here. You are good people who value science and fact-based decision-making. You love your children and want to protect them from climate change. It is on you to change the course we are on. Please make the right choice for them and all children today. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you. Thanks. Next, we have Dan Allegretti.
Thank you very much. My name is Dan Allegretti. I'm with Sigma Consultants. I'm here today on behalf of Hull Street Energy, which is the owner and operator of several Class 2 hydroelectric facilities here in the Commonwealth. First of all, we want to applaud both the Baker administration and the department for the effort to streamline and clarify regulations. We think that's certainly admirable. We will be filing written comments through our trade association, the Bay State Hydropower Association, and we'll try to offer some specific guidance. But I did want to at least highlight two issues that we're focused on as we develop comments and that are of concern to us. We'd like to ask you to give some thought to. The first is the removal of language in the regulations that specifically addresses imports of Class 2 resources. We understand the desire to clarify, and we understand some of the difficulties associated with enforcement that may be inherent in those regulations. But in general, keeping intact the general obligation to settle the energy within the New England market and to provide documentation that is satisfactory to the agency to show that, in fact, the imports have been delivered, we think is pretty foundational. And whether that is duplicative of what's in GIS regulations or statute, we think it's useful to have language in the regulations that puts producers, sellers on notice that there are, in fact, obligations and that they are accountable to providing adequate documentation to the agency associated with import transactions. So we'd encourage you to take a closer look at those provisions and to tread carefully in terms of removing all of that language and consider ways in which you can be clearer and more transparent with regard to what are the fundamental obligations associated with import transactions. The second area we noted was the change to the minimum standard and the ACP associated with waste-to-energy facilities. Whatever support for waste-to-energy facilities may be part of the solid waste plans for the Commonwealth and the public policies, we would encourage you to think through whether there are implications for the market for the balance of Class 2 resources that could result from changes that are specific to waste-to-energy facilities. Obviously, as hydropower facilities providing Class 2 certificates, we're very concerned about what potential market impacts there could be for the residual Class 2 market. And we'd like to see that remain a viable, vibrant, and well-working market. Thirdly, I just want to say I'm really succinct today. Thank you. Any questions, I'd be happy to address.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. Next, we have Ted Wade.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Ted Wade. I'm the co-chair of the Environmental Ministries Program of the Massachusetts Conference of the United Church of Christ. And today I'm speaking in opposition to the proposed woody biomass eligibility changes to the RPS. The Massachusetts Conference of the United Church of Christ, or the UCC, is the largest Protestant denomination in Massachusetts, with 350 churches and over 70,000 members. The Massachusetts UCC has a long history as champions of justice. We published the first anti-slavery tract long ago, and in 2009 we became the first church body in America to pass a science-based resolution on climate change. In 2017, the National UCC Synod, representing 5,100 churches and 1.1 million members, passed a resolution of witness that declares, "The earth is the Lord's and not ours to wreck." I won't read the rest of the theologically based rationale there. However, our Environmental Ministries Program in Massachusetts is a faith-based response to the climate crisis. Our challenge is to preserve and restore God's creation and to protect the future of our planet and, more importantly, the future of all peoples living today and in the future. And this is where the existential nature and the moral nature of this climate crisis comes in. We support a variety of programs with and through our churches and their members. We encourage churches to become green congregations. We encourage individuals to be civically engaged through the Creation Care Voter Pledge, which is an offshoot, a faith-based offshoot of the Environmental Voter Project. More specifically today, our ask, in proposing changes to the RPS that would facilitate and provide incentives for wood-burning power plants, the DOER has lost sight of its moral compass. Like the money changers in the temples of old, the DOER is catering to special interests. We feel certain that the DOER is fully aware of the myriad and extensive harms that would result from its proposals and knows that the proposed changes are a contradiction to the purpose of the renewable portfolio standard. Surely the DOER knows that we only have a dozen years or so to dramatically reduce CO2 emissions, and that we cannot recapture increased emissions from burning wood in the time that we have left to avoid the worst climate consequences. Surely the DOER knows that removing biomass from the forest depletes the soil necessary for regrowth. Surely the DOER knows that science is clear that we must not only stop CO2 emissions, but also sequester emissions already in the atmosphere, and knows that our forests are currently the only effective means of doing this. Surely the DOER knows that Massachusetts cities already have the highest asthma rates in the nation, and surely the DOER knows that there would be significant human toll and public health costs resulting from increased asthma rates, and that human toll and public health burden will largely fall on low-income and disadvantaged communities. So we ask that the DOER take a deep breath, reflect on the harms that are proposed, remind themselves that with great power comes great responsibility, a responsibility for the common good, reset its moral compass, and withdraw the proposed biomass changes to RPS eligibility. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, we have Caitlin Field Sloan.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments. My name is Caitlin Field Sloan. I'm a senior attorney with Conservation Law Foundation here in Boston. And we're going to be providing written technical comments, so I'm going to keep these hopefully brief. My colleague, Kirsty Petchy, will also be providing comments on the waste to energy related provision, so I'm not going to touch on that today. She'll be at a future hearing. There's a local effect and a global effect to energy policy. Right now, the global effect of energy policy in the Commonwealth is that we need to be taking every step toward meeting the 2050 greenhouse gas emission reduction requirements of the GWSA, and beyond that, we hope to see amendment to that statute so that we're actually aiming at net zero in line with the IPCC recommendations. And we believe that every step DOER takes needs to be carefully calibrated to that requirement. It's especially true in the renewable portfolio standard because so much of the what we anticipate to be the 2030 and beyond clean energy and climate plan will rely on the renewable portfolio standard and other clean energy regulations for the electric sector. It's incontrovertible that the smokestack emissions from electric biomass plants are larger than those of fossil, and so reaching any kind of climate neutrality or benefit in the biomass sphere relies on a very sophisticated and detailed balancing. It's not an economic question, it's a science question, it's a climate question, it's a moral question. The current RPS regulations for biomass, while not perfect, represented a lengthy stakeholder process and compromise and science-based resolution to this question that was put forward by the Patrick administration. And stepping back from that is truly a mistake on the global scale. On the local scale of energy policy here, there are very real communities who will see increased air pollution, toxic air pollutants, and particularly fine particulate matter, which exacerbates asthma and cardiovascular diseases. CLF supports our local partners in Springfield, Massachusetts, in opposition to the Palmer Renewable Energy Plant, and we have opposed that plant since it was first proposed, along with those partners. The Department of Public Health has found Springfield to have significantly worse air quality and markedly higher rates of respiratory illness than the state average in Massachusetts. Building this plant would only exacerbate those problems, adding damaging particulate matter and other pollutants to a community that can least afford this additional pollution. The proposed changes appear tailored to funnel electric customer money to this plant and those like it. The proposed changes are not a credible path toward a GWSA-compliant Massachusetts, and they only increase the immediate and long-term health burdens on one of the Commonwealth's most vulnerable communities. We'll provide more detail in our written comments, and I can send by email a version of these.
Thank you. That'd be great. Next, we have Stephen Kaufman.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Kaufman. I'm Managing Director of Clean Asset Partners Corporation, a Massachusetts company that provides SREC and REC management for renewable energy system owners. Thank you all for the opportunity to testify. I respectfully ask DOER to reconsider the proposed changes to the RPS Class 1 regulation that would limit SREC 1 creation to the first 40 calendar quarters of each qualified project's eligibility. That would reverse DOER's previously stated intentions and its interpretation of the program rules to date. While some stakeholders mistakenly thought the 40-quarter opt-in terms for the SREC 1 clearinghouse auctions also applied to the length of time projects could create SREC 1s, DOER has always been clear. The opt-in terms apply to the clearinghouse auctions. All SREC 1 projects would be eligible to create SREC 1s until the program ends, but can only use the clearinghouse auctions during their first 40-quarter, during the 40-quarter opt-in terms. And in addition to the regulations themselves, DOER provided written documentation making this explicit. The proposed change would cut short SREC 1 creation for each of the nearly 12,000 qualified projects, terminating the program 4 years early for the earliest participants and by at least one quarter, even for the last projects to begin participating. Many of those who would be impacted were early adopters. Over 10,000 of the qualified systems are residential, and I think about half or more of those are owned by the homeowner. There are also many systems that are owned by cities and towns, nonprofit organizations, and private businesses, large and small. This would conflict with DOER's assurance that projects could create SREC-1s through the project's final compliance year, changing the rules that solar investors relied on since the program's inception, which have continued to be relied on when projects changed owners and the successor owners or their representatives checked to confirm that the same rules and interpretation were still in place. So I would urge DOER to reconsider, stick with the current rules, and not make the proposed change. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Next, we have Paul Dale.
So good afternoon. I'm Paul Dale. I do thank you for the opportunity to speak in opposition to the proposed biomass eligibility changes to the RPS. I am the Energy Committee Chair for the Massachusetts Chapter of the Sierra Club. The Massachusetts Chapter has over 130,000 members and supporters, and these proposed changes are a source of great alarm for all of our constituents and members. For many reasons. You may recall back in 2012, over 100,000 people endorsed a ballot measure that would have permanently banned biomass from the RPS. And a compromise was reached at that time, as the first speaker mentioned, so that we now have a very limited but existing biomass capability in the RPS. But what we called climate change then is now the climate crisis. The science is unequivocally clear that time is up. We have only a few years to dramatically reduce emissions, and certainly we cannot afford to increase or incentivize or go backwards on that. Thousands of citizens in the Commonwealth and Massachusetts CRPS members and supporters across the state advocated for raising the RPS percentage from 1% to 2%. Last term. They did not lobby to increase the RPS, only to see it watered down by including dirty energy, and such as biomass, and such as waste energy. So the idea in the proposal of extending the time frame from 20 years to 30 years for biomass facilities to show a net reduction in CO2 relative to fossil fuels, it's just absurd. In fact, any proposal whatsoever that incentivizes or facilitates increases in emissions or inhibits the transition to a clean energy economy, inhibits the adoption of non-emitting electricity generation, violates the GWSA. It violates the dictates of the UN IPCC report and the National Climate Assessment. And as previous speakers have noted, not only must we cut emissions, the IPCC report makes it crystal clear that we actually have to sequester that which has already been emitted. And it turns out that the forests in Massachusetts have the highest sequestration rate of any forest in New England because they're still actively growing. When we kill the trees, we, of course, kill the ability for those trees to sequester CO2. At the time when we absolutely need that most, which is right now, when we have no other effective means of achieving sequestration. Harvesting and burning trees is also non-renewable. It actively depletes the soils. It disrupts nature's balance, which requires that biomass actually decay in the forests themselves. And as we've already heard, these proposals would create immediate harm in many dimensions. We have some of the cities with the highest asthma rates in the country. We're going to be creating, if you went through with these proposals, a huge private and public health care costs associated with dealing with the effects of pollution. We're significantly going to degrade the quality of life for the people who deal with the effects of pollution. And this is really an environmental injustice matter because the wood-burning facilities would inevitably be cited in places close to low-income or disadvantaged peoples and populations. So for these and other reasons, the Massachusetts Sierra Club, our members and our supporters, strenuously object to all the proposed biomass alterations to Class 1 and Class 2 eligibility. I do thank you for the time here. And I have one procedural question. You mentioned something at the beginning about APS changes not being accepted after today. Is that true for written comments?
Yes, that is true. Written comments on the APS changes are due today. That is it's an emergency rulemaking, moving at a faster pace than the other ones.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you. Next up, we have, I believe it's Tally Smukler.
Hi. My name is Tally Smukler. I work with Unitarian Universalist Massachusetts Action, and I'm speaking in opposition to the proposed changes. For the 20,000 Unitarian Universalists in Massachusetts, climate action and justice is our top priority. We believe that we must be good stewards of the earth and that decisions we make today will impact generations to come. We also recognize the dire consequences being faced worldwide by people today. Forced migration due to climate change is an escalating problem. The last thing any government should be doing right now is weakening the laws that protect us and subsidizing carbon-producing fuel sources. This is exactly what the DOER proposed changes will do. In 2012, Massachusetts led the way in setting standards that accepted the science of climate change and placed us on a responsible path, one that demonstrated it cared for the future of its people. Today, we understand that the changes in our environment are happening more rapidly than anticipated. We have less than 12 years to drastically reduce carbon emissions in order to avoid catastrophic consequences worldwide. In many areas of the world, those catastrophic consequences have already arrived. The DOER proposal will pave the way for a government-subsidized biomass plant in Springfield. Springfield is an environmental justice community, meaning that it already suffers the burden of a toxic environment. This is an area that already struggles with poverty, high asthma rates, and children and inadequate resources. No people or places in Massachusetts should ever be sacrificed again in order to provide energy to the Commonwealth. Now is the time to invest in our future, in new clean renewable energy sources that don't add more greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. Now is the time to be replanting forests that sequester carbon in our atmosphere. Now is the time for bold change that propels us into the future. We at UU Mass Action implore you not to make the proposed changes. I ask you to consider the well-being of all Massachusetts residents, and I ask you to protect our shared future and not propel us backwards.
Thank you. Next, we have Shannon Ames.
Good afternoon. Thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Shannon Ames. I'm the Executive Director of the Low Impact Hydropower Institute. I'm here today to offer comments related to the inclusion of hydropower as a Class 1 and Class 2 resource. The Low Impact Hydropower Institute, known as LIHI for short, is a national nonprofit organization formed in 2000 by a coalition led by American Rivers and Green Mountain Energy Company. The goal is to reward those who worked to reduce the environmental, recreational, and historical impacts of hydropower generation. We do this by offering the nation's only independent certification and verification program. Voluntary certification is accessible to any existing hydropower as well as new projects constructed on non-powered dams capable of meeting 8 science-based criteria with specific goals designed to protect water quality, ecological flows, upstream and downstream fish passage, watershed systems, endangered species, cultural and historic resources, and recreational access. Our criteria, evaluation, and certification process are extensively vetted through our governing board and advisory panels of industry and environmental experts, and all changes are open for public comment. LIHI has been or is governed by people who work with local and national environmental organizations. Our advisory board is made up of hydropower industry professionals from Massachusetts, New England, and across the country. Massachusetts has been a national leader in the responsible adoption of renewable energy since expansion of the RPS through the Green Communities Act of 2008. The inclusion of hydropower in the RPS was a recognition of hydropower's past and future contribution and role in the Commonwealth's electricity mix. At the same time, there was a recognition that hydropower, unlike most other renewable technologies, is uniquely intertwined with the natural world in which it operates, which raises its environmental risk profile. To minimize this risk, the DOER, after significant input from stakeholders, promulgated 225 CMR to require generation units that use hydroelectric energy to demonstrate compliance with the statutory requirement that hydropower meet, quote, appropriate and site-specific standards that address adequate and healthy river flows, water quality standards, fish passage and protection measures, and mitigation and enhancement opportunities in the impacted watershed via LEED certification or an equivalent. It should be noted that in doing so, the Commonwealth has partnered with LEED, a well-established, non-biased, scientifically rigorous organization, to secure the hydropower standards required without having to develop and employ the ongoing level of internal hydropower expertise necessary to make such determinations. In short, the partnership between LEED and the Commonwealth achieves the desired result, low-risk hydropower at no cost to taxpayers. One could argue that this relationship has already achieved the streamlining sought by Order 562. The recently proposed amendments to CMR 225 threatens to undermine this delicate balance. Specifically, Leahy believes that the addition of language stating that, quote, a generation unit that has received a certification from Leahy and a statement of qualification from the department shall not be required to obtain a recertification from Leahy in order to retain its statement of qualification, end quote, could have serious environmental and programmatic consequences. Requiring Leahy certification at only one point in time fails to appreciate the importance of ongoing reviews. Rivers are a public resource that are also fragile and dynamic ecosystems. Hydropower operations are equally dynamic as they respond to daily, seasonal, and or longer-term changes, like fish migration patterns, flood or drought conditions, or third-party upstream or downstream operations. This is why LEAHE conducts an annual review to ensure ongoing compliance and requires a comprehensive recertification every 5 to 10 years. This ongoing review was a known expectation when the Green Communities Act compromise was struck. We believe that the proposed language, if adopted, will certainly disincentivize recertifications and may also lead hydropower operators to withdraw from LEAHE immediately after showing proof of certification to the department, thus avoiding any annual reviews. If the proposal is adopted, conceivably the department and utilities would be allowing hydropower to benefit from RPS incentives for years, even decades, after confirmation that the environmental standards clearly promulgated in the RPS regulations and in statute are met. In addition, it was the understanding that each REC paid for would meet this standard, and is it impossible to ensure this without systematic review by those with hydropower expertise. It is our understanding that the motivation for the proposed change is concerns around LEAHE's costs and redundancy with the mandated FERC licensing of hydropower. I'd like to take a moment to address these. Regarding costs, the annual cost of LEAHE certificate holders represents less than one-half of 1% of annual mass REC sales. The compromise struck in the Green Communities Act was predicated on the RPS windfall to existing generation to go to those demonstrating care of and reinvestment in river systems. This was achieved to the extent possible by requiring LEAHE certification. Regarding redundancies with FERC and other agencies, LEAHE is not a permitting agency. No hydropower project requires LEAHE certification to operate. Agencies are consulted during the application process, but no formal comments are required. In addition, the environmental criteria used by LEAHE are not automatically included in FERC licenses. FERC must balance environmental needs with power system needs once every 30 to 50 years. LEAHE's criteria, which are paraphrased in the Green Communities Act, are evaluated in a site-specific but watershed-wide manner, ensuring to the best we can continually safe environmental operations. In conclusion, we appreciate the in-depth review the department has undertaken with the RPS regulations as a whole and its desire to reduce costs and bureaucracy. We appreciate the ongoing inclusion of LEAHE, but strongly recommend against limiting hydropower operators to a one-time demonstration of LEAHE certification. Working together, LEAHE and the department have become national model for hydropower's inclusion in green power programs. States like Oregon and national programs like GreenE have replicated the model, and others are sure to follow. In fact, we field calls regularly from around the world asking about the program and the partnership. We implore the department to leave the language as it is currently written and continue to encourage hydropower generators to embrace stakeholder input and environmental stewardship. And I will submit more technical comments at a later date. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have John Clark.
My name is John Clark, and I'm a licensed practicing forester, educated at the University of Massachusetts with dual majors in forestry and natural resource conservation. I'm a lifelong nature enthusiast, hiker, and green industry stakeholder, and I feel compelled to share my thoughts on the presented regulatory changes. I'd like to thank the DOER for preparing these changes and for accepting public comment. I'd also like to commend the Baker-Polito administration for taking up the issue of reducing carbon emissions to mitigate climate change. As I'm sure you're well aware, within the Commonwealth, our carbon emissions are contributing to the greenhouse effect warming our global climate. In light of the federal administration weakening its environmental agencies, it has become increasingly important for carbon reduction to occur at the state level. I practice sustainable forestry in my daily business and know that there is opportunity for sustainably derived wood chips to provide local renewable fuels for thermal, electric, and cogeneration facilities. These fuels are renewable and will directly replace fossil fuels, leaving ancient carbon in the ground and utilizing biogenic carbon for our energy needs. As a forestry professional with decades of experience within the Commonwealth, I can appreciate that the proposed regulatory changes will be met with considerable resistance from many who would wish our energy to be found elsewhere. While I differ from many of these individuals in my assessment of natural resources, I genuinely appreciate their commitment to environmental stewardship and best practices. To that end, I see the proposed changes to 225 CMR 14 as making perfect sense. Every day within the Commonwealth, our need to mitigate arboricultural hazards creates enormous quantities of wood chips, most of which is either trucked out of state or allowed to decompose in place. From the moment these trees were identified as growing in the wrong place, their bound carbon and its release was imminent. Decomposition and combustion release exactly the same amount of carbon. I see the proposed regulation as recognizing these facts, allowing the resulting materials to be more locally and more responsibly utilized. While I enthusiastically support the majority of the proposed RPS changes, I am, however, confused to see that the proposed regulations no longer list land clearing material as an eligible feedstock. While this omission may be in deference to some who may believe its inclusion would promote the removal of forest, they could not be more wrong. While I support the notion that land clearing is the greatest threat to the Commonwealth's forest, this material, like that originating from the urban forest or utility project, is preordained through the planned creation of our housing developments, college campuses, ball fields, solar farms, and so on. I therefore humbly propose that the DOER return land clearing derived clean wood to the list of eligible material with the provision that the clearing was first permitted. I see this nuance will prevent any speculative forest impacts and limit the material to that which was to be inevitably created. I am asking both DOER and the Baker-Polito administration to please take the responsible step of promulgating the regulatory changes while allowing chips generated through permitted land clearing activities to remain eligible within 225 CMR 14. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Deborah Donovan.
Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Donovan. I'm the Massachusetts Director of Acadia Center. I appreciate this opportunity to submit testimony here today in response to the proposed changes to the Massachusetts RPS. Acadia Center is a nonprofit research and advocacy organization committed to advancing the clean energy future through reliable information, comprehensive advocacy, and collaborative problem solving. Acadia Center joins others here in our focus on the extreme urgency surrounding the need to aggressively address the existential threat that climate change poses to our planet and to humankind. This is the lens through which we're viewing opportunities that state policymakers are pursuing to reduce carbon emissions from all sectors of the economy, including the electric power sector. Massachusetts RPS has been a groundbreaking and successful policy that was made stronger last year through this change to a 2% annual increase of the overall target, which also increases the carbon benefits of the RPS. Unfortunately, there are many of the proposed changes in Acadia Center's view that would undermine the intended purpose of the RPS and the whole purpose of increasing the annual target increase. These changes are lowering the threshold for generators that emit CO2 to participate in the RPS, and as well, some of the changes are relaxing the accountability associated with participation in the RPS market, which will further erode the climate benefits to the program. Acadia Center is urging DOER to preserve the climate protective goals of the RPS program and withdraw from consideration those changes that would cause a reversal of some of the most protective aspects of the RPS. Briefly, I'd like to touch on our concern over the sweeping changes to the rules governing the participation of biomass. At the outset of the RPS, the inclusion of biomass as an eligible fuel and receive incentives under the RPS was problematic and controversial. But in 2012, as others have noted, there was an update to the RPS rules regarding biomass that added in science-based standards that address the carbon balance of the biomass life cycle through a very extensive stakeholder process that resulted in a compromise. We see the proposal as written now as a dramatic reversal of those standards, and we will further outline our concerns and our objections to those in our written testimony later. Another issue that is a cause of concern that will be the focus of Acadia Center's comments is the issues raised by the changes to the requirements for imported energy that would allow that energy to earn RPS-eligible RECs accounted through the NEPOOL GIS system and to participate in the Class 1 market as well as other aspects of the New England REC market. The current rules are really important for preventing double counting of the RPS-like attributes for eligible generation, making sure that those attributes are not being counted, say, in New York's inventory and also in the Massachusetts RPS. The rules, as they're written now, prevent greenwashing or round-tripping. This is a type of market arbitrage that exporters could more easily execute that would result in the leakage of the attributes that we are buying RECs for RPS because it makes it harder to determine which generation is actually eligible for RPS compliance. These rules, the way they're currently written, not the proposed ones, also level the playing field between those generators that are eligible to create Class 1 RECs within New England, and that playing field levels with the generators that are adjacent to New England and can export energy into New England. We see the removal of these requirements as creating some significant concerns. It would mean that the Massachusetts RPS would be operated under a different set of import documentation requirements that are in conflict with the current NEPOOL GIS operating rules and are in use by the other New England states. And this would also be in conflict with the legislative intent of the RPS as well as the intent of the Green Communities Act. Relaxing these delivery requirements has the opportunity to create these opportunities for market shenanigans and artificially increase the REC supply, and that would undermine the value of those legitimate REC generators that are located in here in our region. It would devalue these attributes, and it would also cause some ripple effects because a lot of other programs peg their definition of eligibility of a REC to what's in the RPS rules. So we have a concern about what this implication would sort of bleed over into the Clean Peak Standard, the Clean Energy Standard, and even the use of Class 1 RECs for municipal green municipal aggregation, which is becoming a growing area of demand for environmental attributes. So we'd like to encourage you to refrain from making these dramatic changes to the deliverability of imports. They cause market uncertainty, and that would really disrupt the market at a time when we really need to incentivize the development and operation of renewable energy units that are actually lowering carbon emissions and just not getting rewarded for playing a shell game that they could with these more relaxed rules. Very briefly, we're also evaluating the proposed removal of the provisions that would require the non-intermittent exporters to make a commitment of their capacity into the New England wholesale capacity market. First of all, we have a concern because that requirement is in the Green Communities Act, and there was a reason why that was put in there. And the other, I guess my question will be, is that we're really interested in what the practical reason is for that change and how you might demonstrate that this change wouldn't undermine the integrity of the attribute markets further. So we're very interested in hearing that. There's a lot of controversy right now about the importation of attributes from under the 83 statute through from the Hydro-Quebec proposed Hydro-Quebec contract, and so you know folks are really looking closely at that those arrangements to make sure that there's a maintaining a historical baseline, making sure there's a level playing field, and having, you know, some kind of equivalent monitoring and verification system. And so we're just really concerned that, you know, further relaxation through these kind of changes would have some unintended consequences and might affect things like the clean energy standard or future clean energy procurement. So we'd just like to encourage you to think about what the ripple effect might be of some of these changes. So I've submitted my written comments here today, and we will be providing further comments in writing. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Tim Graham.
Good afternoon. I guess this is the moment I find out that I signed the wrong sheet over there. But I'm here today on behalf of our customer base. We're one of the largest aggregators of alternative energy credits here in Massachusetts, a customer base of about 100 megawatts or so of combined heat and power that is actively exceeding efficiency levels of 68%. And also for our handful of anaerobic digester clients that have a great concern on the existing market conditions and where they're going and the relaxing of standards to allow more people into the alternative energy credit program. So I just want to just pass along comment to that. Out in the marketplace, what we're seeing is there's a stunting of growth of combined heat and power and anaerobic digestion because of the instability of the market, primarily due to the added technologies that have been included into the alternative energy credit program. And with the further suggestion of relaxing of regulations to add more into the program, there is even a bigger concern. So I'm just here to make that comment quick and easy. I'll send something off in formal writing. My chicken scratches as I was sitting here writing over here. But the program has been around since 2008. We qualified the first site, a Acushnet company, Titleist Golf Balls. They've had a great success in the program. The revenue from the alternative energy credits is considered part of the annual revenue stream. So future projects going on here, wind of prices in the alternative energy program decreasing and further decreasing if we start oversupplying the market. So while I understand and respect the administration's counterbalancing between protecting ratepayers and the costs associated with ratepayers, and also the return on investment for new projects. So we're getting to the tipping point here where prices are going to continue to lower, and the concern is that CHP is going to continue to decrease in development going forward. So I just ask that to be on the record there. And then lastly, and I know this is coming up in the future, in the biofuels industry, and we've all seen what's gone on in newspapers and on TV, I ask that the DOER reconsider the relaxing of regulations for the biofuels. To have a customer base that's up to 20% of the market have a relaxed standard on requirements versus combined heat and power customers and small renewable thermal customers that are required to deliver information all the way down to the point of use, and to have a biofuels industry that's not to the same standard. That is a huge concern that I have, the industry has, and I just want to make note of that, and I thank you.
All right. Thank you, Tim. Next we have Dave Wilby.
Good afternoon. I'm Dave Wilby, Wilby Public Affairs, here on behalf of my client, Wheel Rider Technologies.
the company will file more extensive comments in this process, and I'll just touch on a couple of the key points here now. First and foremost, Wheelabrator strongly supports the draft rules increase in both the minimum standard in the waste energy tier and the adjustment in the ACP rate for the compliance years of 2019 through 2025. The company very much appreciates the department taking a very fundamental review of this tier and proposing this rule to better align those fundamentals given the way that the market dynamics have shifted since that tier was created. The department, I think it's fair to say, has been aware of these this imbalance and has already tried some remedial action, as you know, in the banking side a few years back, but it's clear to us that that the supply and demand are enough out of balance that a more fundamental adjustment of this tier is needed at this time. You know, put simply, this tier has not been performing as originally intended, and the impact has and continues to be significant on the seven facilities that operate in the state. We think the proposal and the rule will go a long way toward rebalancing this tier for the compliance years 19 through 2025. As you all are well aware, the fact that half of the value of this tier that's created for the facilities is required to go back to DEP means that the ACP will remain, in essence, well below what the rest of Class 2 has in terms of what it means to the facilities. That said, it would certainly be a significant step forward nonetheless. You know, we think it's important to be mindful of the fact that this change is really about maintaining the status quo in terms of the waste-to-energy infrastructure in the Commonwealth. This proposal provides no encouragement for expansion of capacity, which is under a moratorium in any event. This is about adjusting the tier so it does what it is intended, preserves the capacity that currently exists, and allow for some investment to maintain it. We have done some math, but we believe that there's a very minimal rate impact from the provisions in the rule. And again, even though it's quite minimal, half of that essentially goes back to support recycling programs anyway. As a final note, Wheelabrator supports the rule's provision for a periodic review every 5 years for the adjustments that are made here. However, the company doesn't support and doesn't agree with the function of automatically reverting to their current levels after compliance year 2025. You know, based upon the current information that we all have, the ACP and the minimum standard level are wholly inadequate, frankly, and thus the value of pre-setting a return to these numbers without even an inflation adjustment, I should note, it's sort of difficult to understand. It would add a lot of uncertainty and reduce predictability, which is tough in terms of trying to make investment and enter into contracts with municipalities for their waste disposal needs. So accordingly, we encourage you all to keep the five-year review but strike this automatic sunset. Otherwise, the company supports the Class 2 waste tier rule as proposed. And thank you very much for your efforts and for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Dave. Next, we have Sophia Owen.
Good afternoon. My name is Sophia Owen. I'm the legal director and the Eastern Massachusetts community organizer with Toxics Action Center, and I'm here today to express my opposition to the proposed rule changes to the 2012 RPS regulations and any subsidies for biomass or waste incineration. At Toxics Action Center, we work side by side with community groups to tackle environmental threats and develop and train new leaders for the environmental and social change movements. From our work in frontline communities, including more than 15 years supporting groups fighting the expansion and continued use of wood-burning power plants and incinerators, we know that we have every reason to be concerned about the effects of these facilities on our public health and the environment. And I'd like to share three reasons with you today. First, burning trees and trash makes people sick and degrades our environment. When waste is burned, not only do the dioxins, heavy metals, and other toxins in ash particles cause cancer, reproductive health problems, and learning disabilities, but they also build up in the environment and magnify in the food chain, posing serious developmental and health threats to wildlife and people. Just ask the folks living around the incinerator in Saugus. The EPA has also linked particulate matter created by burning trees to difficulty breathing, aggravated asthma, and heart attacks. Second, we know we need to be charting a path to zero waste, not incentivizing so-called waste-to-energy facilities that are not carbon neutral. Take the Wheelabrator facility in Saugus, for example. Wheelabrator currently buries 100,000 tons of ash each year, but according to the company's own records, about 80% of the materials being burned there are recyclable or compostable. Instead of allowing the wood and waste-burning industries to continue to trash our environment and public health, the DOER should be working with the DEP to aggressively pursue policies that will reduce waste, spur local green environment economic innovation, and offer safe and well-paying jobs to residents and local communities. Finally, burning waste and trees is an environmental justice issue. Communities of color and low-income communities are already overburdened by the cumulative impact of pollution from power plants, incinerators, landfills, and transportation. For example, Springfield, which as you know is the site of a trash incinerator and a proposed biomass facility, was rated the worst place in the country this year if you have asthma. Rather than caving to industry and perpetuating environmental racism, the DOER should be listening to frontline communities who have fought for years to ensure that their communities can breathe cleaner air. For all of these reasons, I ask you to protect Massachusetts residents' health and the environment by not implementing the proposed rule changes to the 2012 RPS regulations and not providing further subsidies for biomass or incineration. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have James McCaffrey.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to comment today and for holding these hearings to hear from folks on this issue. My name is James McCaffrey. I'm the Legislative Director for New England for Partnership for Policy Integrity. We are a science-based advocacy house that works on energy policy globally. And we played a key role in 2012 with a number of the folks that are in this room in having Massachusetts adopt the strongest science-based biomass regulations, definitely in the nation and probably in the world. And that probably still stands to this day and is at risk now for being totally undone by the proposal that's been put forth by DOER. We are very concerned about the abruptness and timing of these regulations when we are in the midst of a climate crisis, as you've heard from many others today. DOER is proposing to expand polluting programs and polluting forms of energies in a stark betrayal of what we achieved in 2012. This represents, in our view, a disregard for public health, climate science, and the global efforts to combat climate change, and will funnel millions of dollars from ratepayers and other sources into polluting technologies. This is a fact. There is really no debate about biomass science and the impacts that this has. In fact, industry representatives often point to the Manomet study, which is the study that was commissioned in 2012 and which led to the development of the science-based regulations that we were able to achieve, and reference the numbers and the data that is in that study that is a peer-reviewed study and has now been upheld by multiple other studies globally. And they talk about the time that it takes to recapture the carbon, even theoretically. If everything is working absolutely perfectly in sync and you are possibly recapturing the carbon from burning trees for electricity or other uses, you're looking at a minimum of 30 to 40 years, often longer, before you reach parity with natural gas or coal. And as you've heard from many others today, we simply don't have that kind of time. now. So it's rather astonishing to us that in the midst of this crisis that a proposal has been brought forth that would actually undo these regulations, put more carbon dioxide and more traditional air pollutants into the atmosphere, including, as noted by so many others, typically in frontline communities, environmental justice communities, and disproportionately impact sensitive populations and other disadvantaged members and citizens and residents of Massachusetts and beyond. It's interesting to look at this conversation because on one side you have advocates coming forward and talking about climate science, talking about climate change, talking about public health, talking about frontline communities. These are individuals that are coming forward to try and urge you to do the right thing, to protect public health, to protect the climate, to protect the environment, protect our forests, which, as many have noted, along with the soils that are made up from the residues and much of the debris that comes from the forest that is being proposed to be burnt, makes up the soil that also is one of our major carbon sinks. It's actually accurate to say that the forest and the soil are what are sequestering the carbon that we have right now. And according to the IPCC report that others have also referenced today, it is time for us to actually be increasing that forest mass and that forest carbon uptake, not cutting trees down and hoping that we have 30, 40, 50, sometimes 70 to 80 years, depending on what you purport to be replacing, to recapture that carbon. And again, if everything is working from a policy perspective, which we have great concerns that it will not. So that's the one side of the debate that is sort of a false paradigm and a false dichotomy, much like the please don't take away our opportunity to burn trees for electricity or someone's going to come and clear our land for development. That may be a problem that Massachusetts has to deal with, but using Massachusetts' clean energy policies and Massachusetts' ratepayer dollars to solve a problem that is not related to what we have a global crisis going on right now doesn't make any sense. We should not be taking ratepayer dollars to keep folks employed in industries that are actually creating pollution and making people sick. So on the other side, you have these vested interests that are coming forward and claiming to be trying to help the problem. And the science simply is not on their side, and it simply does not support their claims. And I think and believe that DOER is well aware of this. You are well aware of the science, and you understand how it works. So that's why we are, again, so concerned and sort of astonished that these proposals have been brought forward. I just want to list off for the record, we will be submitting very detailed, as we always do, science-based and data-driven comments on the major key points that we see here that are the major problems with these provisions. I'll just list them off. You'll get a great deal of detail and technical data from us to support these statements. So the proposal will definitely increase CO2 emissions. It will definitely increase air pollution. It will definitely increase wood being treated falsely as having low or zero emissions. It will increase emissions from liquid and gaseous biofuels. It reduces accountability and tracking of fuels burned as biomass, and it reduces and eliminates protections for forests, as well as a number of concerns that we have about the continuing manipulation and changes made to the so-called sustainable forestry provisions. And the last thing I want to leave you with, and that I think this is a fact that folks at DOER are probably very well aware of, but in any given day in New England, if you look at our energy supply and what is happening on the renewable energy front, and this is easy to do. Anyone can do this. You can just go to ISO New England Express and just look at their real-time tracking of where our energy is coming from in New England. More than 50% typically of our so-called renewable energy is coming from burning trees and trash. And DOER has now proposed to increase this amount of energy by incentivizing these industries and adding more pollution and carbon into the atmosphere. So we want to leave you with this thought. We applaud a lot of the work that you have done in the past and the achievements that we made under the Patrick administration and the accomplishments of those policies being in place. And the world is watching. This is a landmark, globally significant, precedent-setting policy based in science. Please do not abandon it. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Next, we have Ania Camarga.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to comment. My name is Ania Camargo. I live in Boston, and I am with Mothers Up Front, as well as Randy. And I am speaking up because I am the mom of two girls, and what you are proposing right now would be harming their future and all kids' future. And it's fun that I go right after James, because I think what you're proposing reminds me of the U.S. dietary guidelines of the late 1990s. My husband was a part of that. And they had scientists and physicians and nutritionists come up with the guidelines. And in the guidelines, there were mandates to add vegetables to the school lunch program to make it so that kids could have healthier lunches. And the guidelines were approved, and the scientists and the nutritionists, everyone went home. And then the food lobby came in and made sure that French fries and pizza and ketchup were counted as vegetables. In that case, the food lobby won, the kids lost, the healthy intent of the U.S. dietary guidelines was completely lost, and today we have an obesity epidemic in children. So that brings us back to what's happening here, in my opinion. The intent of the RPS mandate is to increase clean energy to decrease greenhouse emissions in Massachusetts. And as you've heard from everyone, the biomass power plants, like coal plants, will be spewing pollution, lots of bad quality health pollutants, and they're bad for our local communities, and actually increase our greenhouse gas emissions at the worst possible times. And I think you are also, from what I read, do not include in the CO2 emissions the harvesting, processing, and transportation of the wood. Like coal plants as well, biomass power plants are not efficient at creating energy, and they have to be subsidized. As electric ratepayer, have to subsidize them in order for them to be viable and price competitive. But worse than coal plants, as you've heard, the energy source requires the destruction of trees, which are the best tool we have to capture carbon today. And your proposal eliminates the protections for forests and soils and our ecosystems. I learned from Professor Muma a few months ago that the oldest trees capture the most carbon. I know you're not proposing that, but that is the unintended consequences. Old forests and trees will be cut down to be able to supply for these power plants. So I'm up here today to ask you to please side with the kids, with my kids, with your kids, with everyone's kids, and to meet the intent of the RPS, which is to provide clean energy in our electricity mix, not polluting energy. Because just like French fries will never be a healthy vegetable, biomass power plants are not clean and do not belong in our RPS. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Alice Arena. Okay. Following Alice, we have Bob Gollidge.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. My name is Bob Gollidge. I'm here on behalf of Covanta. And Covanta clearly supports the concept of reduce, reuse, and recycle, and only the irreducible minimums be sent to waste energy facilities. The bulk of my comments today are going to focus on 15.07, the minimum standards, and 15.08, the alternative compliance fees. It's important for the context. Covanta currently operates four waste energy facilities here in Massachusetts. As has been previously mentioned, there are seven waste energy facilities in the Commonwealth. In the context of both the pressures on the solid waste industry and the recent literally crashing of the recycling industry, dealing with our waste is a huge challenge in state. The waste energy facilities in Massachusetts currently handle about 72% of in-state disposal capacity, and that's after encouraging reducing and reusing and recycling. And that's going to continue to be a challenge as landfills throughout the Commonwealth continue to close. So we're going to see in the next 3 to 5 years that percentage of in-state disposal being increased rather than decreased. I think it's also important to note as the Commonwealth is challenged with disposal costs and opportunities, a lot of what's happening is our waste is being shipped out of state, and depending on how it's dealt with out of state, may result in actually increased emissions. So it's something that I know that MassDEP is grappling with through their Solid Waste Master Plan. So again, important context to keep in mind. So Covanta will be submitting additional comments prior to the end of the comment period. Two basic comments that I'd like to make is that reiterating what you heard earlier, that 50% of the revenues from these waste credits go to MassDEP to increase recycling efforts, which is particularly important in this day and age with the crash of the recycling markets. We think that the proposal will help not only municipalities as DEP allocates funds to help municipalities with their recycling efforts, but also opportunities for MassDEP to invest in recycling infrastructure throughout the state. Two comments. So in general, we're supportive of those the changes being proposed. Two things we'd like you to consider, both under 15.07, where essentially the standard, although increased to 3.7% until 2025, reverts back. We believe, as was commented earlier, that rather than essentially sunsetting that portion of the regulations, that a review period be conducted and make the appropriate adjustments at that time. Again, we think it's particularly important to consult with MassDEP during those efforts. But having spent a fair amount of time in the regulatory environment myself, you don't necessarily want to have to go through extensive rulemaking if it's not necessary. Conduct the analysis and the thoughtful review, but don't bind yourself by making that portion of the regulation sunset. Similar comment on 15.08, where you're essentially setting the compliance fee, and in the in 2026 that would revert back to the existing rate of $11.50. We again think that it would be appropriate to, during this next 5-year period, work collaboratively with DEP, evaluate both the rate, the waste markets and the energy markets consistently across that period of time, and take the action necessary at that point in time, but not bind yourself with a sunset provision. Again, I think it's also important to highlight that the Obama administration Clean Air Plan recognized waste-to-energy facilities, highlighting that we want to make sure that it's the irreducible minimums that go to these facilities, actually cut greenhouse gases as compared with other alternatives of landfilling, and therefore we think that shipping waste out of state that ends up in landfills in Ohio and Pennsylvania and other places actually goes against the overall goal of reducing greenhouse gases. So again, thank you for the opportunity to come, and we look forward to working with you as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Next, we have Vic Gatto.
I shouldn't have come after Bob. Thank you very much. Nice to be here. I want to make just 3 points and appreciate the chance to address you in this public hearing. 3 points are the focus on waste wood, and then the second point is the greenhouse gas science as it pertains to that, and the third is the is recognizing the quality of the plants that we're building. I should have said, and I will, I'm the president of Homeland Fuels. We are a company that creates ultra-low sulfur renewable diesel from cellulosic waste materials, both biomass wood and also agricultural waste. I'm also COO of Coletta Renewable Energy, who was the primary sponsor of the Palmer Renewable Energy Plant. I want to focus DOER and my friends in the audience on the fact that the Palmer Renewable Energy Plant is permitted only for tree trimming wood. Tree trimming wood being defined as the wood that's required to be created by the clearing of the lines for utilities. And our partner in providing that wood, Northern Tree Service, has done that for many years, does it for all of the major utilities in New England. And to understand that that wood is important, right now FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, has just mandated the expansion, the doubling of the size of the corridor that protects utility lines from 50 feet to 100 feet, effectively doubling the amount of waste wood, or as you've said, you say in your document, non-forested derived residuals. Harder for me to say that than waste wood. But anyway, doubling the amount of waste wood that's going to be created simply by that tree trimming. To say again, our plant will is permitted to only take tree trimming wood. So it's definitely non-forested, and we're definitely not supportive of the use of trees for the production of this, but we are very supportive of the use of this waste wood for it, as you heard from the various members of the forestry community who are here today. Second point, there's a lot of science, and I guess my friends who are citing it have looked at a lot of it. I'm sure they have. The science that I've looked at, and I will submit to you, shows that the use of waste wood, non-forested derived residuals, for power produces three times fewer greenhouse gas emissions than letting that same residual decompose. The current tree trimmers have no alternative, right? You can't put wood in a landfill here in Massachusetts. There's no other use for it. They basically just leave it sitting there, right? So you have that situation where it's sitting there is because of the complex decomposition phenomenon, which I would challenge anybody to explain to us, produces a combination of greenhouse gases, right? A lot primary in that decomposition is methane, which has significantly more impact than the CO2, but CO2 is also produced there. So three times fewer greenhouse gas emissions by taking that tree trimming wood that we have to produce anyway for the safety of the utility lines, rather than leaving it sitting on the ground, using it for a productive use. The second science that I would point to, there are many articles about this, and I'll submit a couple of them to you, that our plant produces 84% fewer greenhouse gas emissions than a high-efficiency combined cycle natural gas unit. In numbers, it produces 282,000 fewer metric tons of greenhouse gas per year. That's equivalent to 60,000 cars being taken off the road. It's enough to power 30,000 homes. So significant reduction compared to using natural gas as a greenhouse in its greenhouse gas production. Final point, many of my friends who have spoken here today against the your proposal also speak across the country about biomass wood. And they are very eloquent, and they're very good at it, and they have been in many of the states where I have other operations and other opportunities. And every time I get a call from my friends in those states, because often our friends here point to the Palmer Renewable Energy Plant because of two things. First, it has the lowest emission allowable of any biomass plant in the country. DEP can witness that. DEP proudly says that at their own conferences around the country. And secondly, it also is the most efficient biomass plant in the country as well. So we're proud of what we're doing. We're excited about it. We feel these regulations make a lot of sense, as the folks from the forestry industry have pointed out. But more importantly, we want all of our people here to recognize that we're not talking about trees. Trees is not the equation here. We're talking about tree trimming wood that's either going to sit underneath utility lines or be used productively with a resultant reduction in greenhouse gas. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have William Vogela.
follow a fellow short person. Thanks. My name is Bill Vogel. I live in Lexington. I'm representing myself and my kids. I want to reiterate what we've heard. Massachusetts has led in science-based policy. The governor is committed to carbon reduction. So these things are good. Right? And he's a good steward of our ratepayers' resources. He wants to be. But the proposed changes, as we've heard, point us in the wrong direction on all these things. And I just want to focus on three pieces. One is the extension of the time frame from 20 years to 30 years. The second is the redefinition of salvage and wastewood. We've heard about these things already. And the third is the reduction in the efficiency requirements. And so this is kind of the trifecta of pointing in the wrong direction stuff. The first one about the time frame, it's true, trees grow, they sequester carbon, but they don't do it right away. And so the real issue here is what's the policy relevant time frame? And we see in IPCC and all the other studies that this is a short time frame. We need 10 years to use, not 30 years. So 20 is already problematic. Certainly 30 is the wrong answer. And 10 is what the IPCC is pointing us to. So there's the first problem. It's kind of like me taking my chocolate cake and I say, when do I get calorie neutrality? How many days, right? Well, if I pick 4 days on my big piece of chocolate cake, I can get calorie neutrality. It's easy. So I can keep eating cake, right? What's the policy outcome? I'm going to Macy's and buying new jeans, right? And my doc's talking about heart attacks. So the real issue here is what's the time frame that makes sense for what we need to accomplish. The second piece that's related is the wastewood salvage issue. Now, I hear my friends' comments. Unfortunately, what we've seen everywhere is that this is like the camel's nose under the tent. In Europe, we've seen the permissive use of wastewood, and it leads to rapid deforestation. Every plant said, we're only using wastewood. But what they're doing is cutting ancient timbers in southeastern Europe, and they're cutting bottomland hardwoods across southeastern United States. So once you take that 60-year-old oak tree and turn it into pellets and chips, gee, it looks a lot like a scrawny old pine. So you can't tell the difference and you can't get it back. So the problem with redefining expansively what comes from wastewood is that it will lead to the unintended or predictable consequence of taking down more trees because they'll be diseased and so forth. So this isn't a good solution. Finally, the issue about energy efficiency. Well, you know, when I was looking at my boiler in my house, it was running at 60% efficiency, and everybody said, Vogel, you got to get a new boiler. 60-65% is not going to do it. So we shouldn't be reducing the efficiency requirements for any power plant. We need to be increasing them. So these are just three parts of the regulations, changes that are proposed. Short of taking biomass completely out of the RPS, I'm speaking to say this is not the direction that we need to go. It's contrary to the governor's commitments, contrary to climate change science, and it's contrary to what the world that my kids, never mind my grandchildren, need to live. Thanks so much.
Thank you. The last person we have that formally signed up is Anthony Abdelahed.
Thank you all. My name is Anthony Abdelahed. I'm here on behalf of Palmer Renewable Energy. I was called in as a potential backstop in case Mr. Gatto couldn't be here to testify, so I would rest on his comments and only say that we'll be submitting testimony at a later date to, again, point out the forestry impacts and the positive benefits of biomass as it relates to these new standards. So thank you.
So with that actually reaches the end of our list of people that signed up. We still have some time, though. If there are others that would like to testify, you can come up to the mic one at a time. Yep, please do. And when you come up, please introduce yourself and the organization you're with.
Good afternoon. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify against the proposed regulations. My name is Marilyn Lee Smith. I'm former Deputy Commissioner for the Child Support Program at DOR and now an Access to Justice Fellow, working on a variety of conservation and environmental issues. Also a member of the Park Overseers for the Emerald Necklace Conservancy and the Brookline Green Space Alliance. These are two organizations that focus on the health of urban trees, but we're concerned about trees everywhere in the Commonwealth. And I want to concur with what colleagues from who offered other opposition to these regulations in the science, but just to reiterate certain common sense notions that some people claim that trees are renewable energy because they take energy from the sun and can turn it into wood that we can burn and create heat and electricity, and that these trees that are cut down can be replaced by other trees. So what's the big deal? And the big deal is that, as others have said, it takes decades to replace those trees, decades that we do not have if we have a ghost of a chance of meeting our targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by the year 2050. Deforestation, as you well know, is one of the driving forces of climate change. All over the world, people are desperately planting trees to stem the tide, to take carbon from the atmosphere, to keep the flow of water from the earth to the clouds and back again as rain. Trees protect and nourish our soil, and allowing the decomposition of these trees to replenish the soil is critically important to keep our planet healthy. There are very few old-growth forests left in Massachusetts, even in the entire country. Any trees that we're cutting down could potentially replace these old forests so that future generations could enjoy the majesty of ancient trees. I concur with the folks who talk about the slippery slope, that once you start cutting trees and you see the trees are out there for the taking, that there will be an escalation of deforestation. The Commonwealth can really proudly boast that we have more extensive tree cover in the 21st century than we did in the 19th century, when forests were clear cut to make way for farms and pastures for sheep and cattle. Those trees are coming back. They're still kind of scrawny compared to the 100 and 200-year-old trees that they cut down. But it's important for us to stay in leadership, as others have said. The rest of the country looks to Massachusetts for leadership. Where we go, sooner or later, the rest of the country will follow. We really need to set this example and to stay on course and to keep these rigorous standards that are currently in place. We should be planting trees, not cutting them down. So I just want to ask you to not go forward with these proposed regulations, and I thank you for the opportunity to comment. You've been very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to offer testimony?
Right.
Yep.
Hello, good afternoon. Gretchen Fear with Constellation Energy. We are in part a competitive energy supplier, and I'd like to offer comments today on the increased compliance obligations under the RPS Class 2 minimum standard. As the department knows, suppliers enter into multi-year agreements with their customers for fixed price energy. These customers will be faced with unexpected price increases to account for the increased obligation. When a new obligation is imposed or increased, it impacts existing contracts that were priced based on prior obligations and may have a term that exists over many years. These changes in compliance place customers in an untenable budgetary condition and undermine the confidence in the competitive electricity market. Accordingly, we would ask that the department exempt load under contract from compliance obligations until their expiration or renewal date. This is consistent with prior department past practices and would protect stakeholder and customer expectations. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Frank Singleton, a Weymouth Conservation Commission, but also a member of the Four River Residents Against the Compressor Station Board of Directors. My concerns are really over the recent decision to import more energy from Canada for supposed renewable purposes that are based on hydropower. It turns out hydropower is not really a safe renewable issue. There's a lot of damage, but what we seem to be doing here is a couple of things. I'm on an ISO committee, consumer liaison, for years. It seems the grid is changing very rapidly. Offshore wind and other things are coming into play. They were importing with a lot of damage being done, not only to Canada, but also to the transmission corridors coming through upper New England, on the for having a paper game of showing a renewable energy percentage that's increased, which is really not true. I'm saying the grid's changing with offshore wind, with all the other things that are coming, it's changing more. Every time I go to a meeting every 3 months, it's just amazing how quickly things are happening. Are we going to end up with a stranded asset with a major transmission line carved through our forest causing unnecessary damming in another country but still affects the global burden of what they generate? So I'd like to question whether or not the renewable energy should include hydropower anymore, whether that should really be looked at a lot more carefully about whether or not it really is renewable energy and really is it economically necessary anymore. I'm not talking pump storage, which does a lot of damage, too. I'm just talking about the new decision made to increase the percentage of renewable energy so we import a whole bunch of stuff coming from now Labrador and Quebec that we don't really need for the grid, and it's going to cause a lot of peripheral damage if it goes forward.
All right. Is there anyone else? Seeing no one, I think we'll end a little bit early and adjourn the hearing at this time. Thank you.